Thank you. Well, when I was asked to discuss issues and problems in dealing with jets and disks and outflows, I thought that this was this topic was screaming for a top 10 list. So I decided to structure my talk in that way. So this is going to be the top 10 problems in jets, outflows, and disks, which I realize is a risky topic. Because I probably don't have your problem on the list, for some of you. And so I'm only going to go so far. Now, top 10 lists are usually done in order, either in ascending order, from least important to most important, or in descending order, or in or the other way. But I'm not going to try to order these in any sort of way, although I'm sure since I put numbers next to them, they will get, you'll think that I'm ordering them. So I'll get in trouble anyway, but I want to just state my first caveat is that they are not in any sort of order of importance. The other thing is that I have far too much stuff here. I won't tell you how many slides are actually on here, but I tend to edit talks as I go along. And so it's actually good that there really aren't 10 independent problems that I could think of. They're not independent. And you will see that there are not only links between among many of these problems, but actually some of the problems are the same ones. But I think that it's important to ask questions in different ways, because sometimes you get different answers when you ask the same question in several different ways. And so you'll see that I am going to repeat myself, and that will also give me a very convenient way of just running, not talking about slides when I start to run out of time. So I'm just going to start right in. So the first problem on my list, and not the most important necessarily, but those of you who know me might see a certain congruence between the problems and some of the things I've been interested in, are, can black holes power jets? Okay. Well, for each of these topics, I've sort of put in three slides, which is too much for each of 10 topics, starting with what we know, the kinds of approaches people have been using to get at these problems, and what some of the challenges are. And what we know about black holes and jets is that you can extract energy from rotating black holes, and you can probably do this in an astrophysically interesting way using magnetic fields. And for a maximally rotating Kerr black hole, up to 29% of the rest mass is available. Less if the black hole is not rotating, but that's a large amount of mass for almost any significant rotation rate. We also know that this is a very tough problem. Extraction of energy relies on setting up magnetic fields in the vicinity of the black hole using currents, of course, that are outside the black hole, because magnetic fields, black holes cannot support currents for long periods of time inside their horizons. And so this is a very much an astrophysics rather than a relativity problem, in that it depends on the field geometry and strength around the hole. And we know that the magnetic field can connect the region around the black hole where the spin is, where the space-time is spinning, to the accretion disk, to winds. The possible geometries are very complicated, and we haven't really solved this problem, but we know that it's a problem. We also know that as matter swirls into the black hole and it starts to get captured by the swirling of space-time, magnetic fields that connect the regions close to the black hole with regions further out get stretched, and this stretching can transfer stresses. And so in contrast to what the early theories of accretion disks assumed, the stress on rotating material that's swirling into a black hole does not vanish as you get down to the innermost stable circular orbit. But in fact, the stress may be appreciable in the plunge region and can give you some black hole energy extraction from the spin of the black hole, even as material is just swirling into the black hole in an accretion disk. And probably Julian Krolik will talk about this later in the meeting. And finally, we think we see effects of this energy injection from the spin of the black hole in some observations of broad iron lines from the innermost parts of accretion disks. Okay, well, I've already started to talk about some of the approaches that have been taken to this problem. The kind of analysis that has been done has been to try to analyze, to figure out, estimate how strong the magnetic fields can be, because the amount of energy you can extract from a spinning black hole depends on the magnetic energy density. I don't know if this approach has been very successful, because it seems that numerical simulations, which are starting to get quite interesting, particularly with long enough integration times to see something that's beginning to look like a steady state and full general relativity with MHD, these simulations are actually giving more optimistic answers, it seems, about energy extraction than the earlier estimates. And probably that has to do with the fact that the earlier estimates were trying to estimate the magnetic field by estimating pressures, static gas pressures, and probably the plunging of the gas. The Ram pressures are very important, and that allows you to keep more field in the presence of the black hole than people had thought. Observationally, we are at the early stages of trying to get a grip on this problem, both by doing spectroscopy particularly in the iron lines at a few kilovolts, and looking at variability. And this is a slide I stole from Roger Blanford, just giving a one-page summary of the Blanford's Nyack effect, which allows energy to be extracted from the spin of the black hole. And I won't go into the details of that. Here is an observation which Chris Reynolds and Jurn Vilms and others were in charge of. Showing the possibility that there is some energy extraction from the spin of the black hole powering this very broad iron line whose rest energy is 6.4 kilovolts, but you see that there's a very broad tail extending down to 2 kilovolts. We think that that is emission being produced extremely close to the event horizon. Very rapidly rotating black holes allow gas to get close to the event horizon before it plunges. And if you look at the amount of energy that's coming in this very redshifted region, it's too much to be explained by local extraction of gravitational potential energy, or the relativistic analog. So the argument that we've made is that this has to be spin extraction. Finally, the challenges of this field are very, very many. I probably will not keep repeating myself explicitly, but in almost every one of these, we need more computation. In this case, GR MHD with better microphysics, because probably dissipative processes are very important here. We need better microphysics for almost all MHD problems, because we really don't know how to model processes like reconnection. The kind of analysis that's done has to do with how the magnetic field interacts with the ergosphere of the black hole. What is the angular velocity of the field lines relative to the angular velocity of the ergosphere? That's a question that is still being handled to some extent through analysis, but it's going to be ultimately answered probably by computation. And there are a variety of important observational advances that need to be made, which are some of the most important drivers, scientific drivers, for the next generation of X-ray observatories, such as Constellation X and XEUS. That's the first problem. Nine more to go. How relativistic can a jet get? Plenty of time. Yeah. Okay. How relativistic can a jet get is my second question. And you will see that that has some relation to the question that my first question, although it is a somewhat broader question, because we think that relativistic flows not only might be powered by the spin of rotating black holes, but also can be powered in other ways. Now, I think people have been psychologically pretty resistant to extremely relativistic flows. I remember, despite the fact that we've had very strong arguments for many years that pulsar jets can get up to a Lorentz factor of about a million, and that comes out from the old recent gun argument about the Crab Nebula, even Martin Rees was very reluctant to consider the idea that jets could become much more relativistic than about a Lorentz factor of 10, which is what we typically infer from blazars, active galactic nuclei, until he was forced to do so by observations of gamma ray bursts. And so we have now evidence that there is no obvious barrier in sight for the maximum bulk Lorentz factor of relativistic flows. There's no limitation due to radiation drag, for example, to a Lorentz factor of a few, which was an idea people were playing with a few years ago. And so Lorentz factors seem to go anywhere from the sub-relativistic and mildly relativistic jets, which we see in many cases, to gammas of tens, to hundreds in gamma ray bursts. And the gamma ray bursts are particularly interesting because these very relativistic jets emerge from an extremely dense environment, essentially a collapsing stellar envelope, all the way up to pulsar jets at Lorentz factors of a million. The only acceleration mechanism that makes sense that anybody has thought of is some kind of acceleration by coherent electromagnetic fields. And I've emphasized the magnetic here because people usually talk about magnetohydrodynamic processes involving tensions and pressures of magnetic fields flinging things around. But this is actually not necessarily the best way to think of acceleration of extremely relativistic jets, because there's essentially no distinction between electric and magnetic fields when you get up to relativistic energies. Moving magnetic field is an electric field. And in all of these relativistic problems, the displacement current is very important, and you really have to do everything in a fully symmetric way. Nevertheless, you can do some interesting things with quite a few interesting things with thinking of it as MHD. These relativistic speeds seem to be pretty robust. Once something comes out of the center of a galaxy with a Lorentz factor of 10, we see evidence that it can get out to kiloparsecs or even hundreds of kiloparsecs without slowing down much. So these things can punch through their surroundings. The same is true in a scaled-down sense for gamma ray bursts. These relativistic flows are inferred to go out to parsecs before they run into their surroundings and slow down. And finally, it's important to remember that jets are not a relativistic phenomenon. They are a generic phenomenon. And they probably essentially have more to do with rotation and essentially rotation axes and disks than they do with relativistic velocities. We see jets in many non-relativistic situations, such as protostars. And as a general rule, it seems likely that the speed has something to do with the gravitational potential in the region which produces the jets. But that has not by no means been proven. And there are mechanisms which allow you to exert a very large moment arm, for example, with a very stiff magnetic field, spinning something around at a relatively low speed, but with a very rigid arm going out several decades in radius. If you could do something like that, you in principle could produce a relativistic flow from a non-relativistic object. I don't know of any case where that seems likely to have happened, but I don't think anybody has ruled it out. It would be very interesting to see a relativistic jet from a protostar, for example. And I apologize, by the way, that there's essentially no references to protostars in my talk, but that's just my personal thing. But I think there may be one or two. So those of you who are star formation people, sorry. Okay, approaches to this problem of how fast a jet can get. Well, the issues are things like the relationship of jets to disks. We're now broadening the problem beyond the jets coming out of a rotating black hole's ergosphere. So there's the disk-jet correlation and issues of how the jet acquires its mass. You put in a certain amount of energy, you divide that by the amount of mass, and that tells you how fast the jet gets. And so you have to figure out how much mass gets put on the jet. And people suspect that in some cases the very relativistic flows are loaded down not by ordinary electron-ion plasma, but by pairs. That is unlikely to be true in situations like gamma ray bursts, but we don't really know in the case of blazars, although there have been some efforts to figure this out. Computation, well, I've said this before, so I won't repeat myself. Same needs as for the previous problem. And for observation, we have learned, we're starting to learn a lot by looking at systems where we can see time dependence occurring in real time, and that means low mass systems. There is a suspicion that there's some very nice scaling laws between the low mass systems, such as so-called microquasars, which are a type of X-ray binary producing jets, and active galactic nuclei. Instead of things occurring in hundreds of thousands of years, or tens of thousands of years. Microquasars should do things over time scales of a few minutes. And indeed, we can see them doing things varying on these time scales. And so by looking at many different wavelengths, one can try to sort out the dynamical processes that are occurring. One can also resolve jets down to very small scales using very long baseline interferometry. And in the case of blazar jets, we've learned a lot by studying variable gamma rays, which require a very large, which exhibit relativistic effects, we think, pretty clearly, up to TeV energies. Okay, and the challenges in this field, there are actually a few significant analytic challenges. One of them is to really improve our treatment of magnetohydrodynamics as applicable to the ultra-relativistic case. One interesting approach in this direction is going on with Roger Blanford and Max Ludikov to essentially develop the relativistic force-free approximation, in which you do force-free magnetohydrodynamics, but you include the displacement current. More work can be done on the composition of jets, pairs versus normal plasma. As always, there's more computation that needs to be done. But in this case, I think it's important to note that even though people are now doing three-dimensional general relativistic MHD, there's a lot of interesting work that needs to be done just using special relativistic MHD, particularly with adaptive mesh codes, because you tend to form very thin sheets when you have relativistic flows running into things. And these have really not been studied very well numerically. And observationally, it's actually difficult to diagnose the speeds of relativistic jets because we don't know the difference between when we see something moving on the sky, and amazingly you can actually see these things that are a gigaparsec away moving on the sky because they're moving so fast, and they appear to be moving faster than the speed of light because of the illusion when stuff comes nearly towards us. Despite the fact that we can map these motions and even structures in many situations, we still don't know if these are actually, these speeds represent the bulk speeds of objects, of blobs of matter, or pattern speeds, some kind of shock waves or reconnection front or something like that. We also don't know what kinds of microphysical processes are going on in these jets, and that depends a lot on whether the jets are made of hadrons or leptons. And for example, it's possible that there are all kinds of processes producing ultra-relativistic neutrinos and neutrons and things like that in some of these objects. And perhaps we can get a better handle on this problem observationally. Okay, still have a lot of time. Third problem, which is related to the second problem. So you see these really are probably like three problems. How and where do jets get accelerated and collimated? Okay. Well, this is a broadening of the problem once again, because this question is relevant to all kinds of jets, not just relativistic ones, and certainly not just ones that are being produced by black holes. What we know is that jets are produced, or at least in one case, a jet is produced very close to the central object. And here is the wonderful montage of M87. Where you go from scales of something like, this is about 80 kiloparsecs, down to smaller and smaller scales, until you reach this map here, where the smallest elongated structures here are about 50 Schwarzschild radii, or I don't know, I wrote 100 m here, but I don't know exactly what the number is, but it's, you know, it's less than 100 Schwarzschild radii, I think. We know that the jet in this case is already well focused, and it's also one-sided, which we pretty sure means that it's already relativistic, on these very small scales. We don't have this kind of evidence for a large number of objects, though. What we know theoretically is that when you try to produce a jet and accelerate it over these small scales, unless you somehow fling it outwards already with a large velocity, by some kind of a dissipative effect, you know, just sort of energizing the whole structure all at once. If you rely on electromagnetic acceleration, this tends to be a very slow process. And relativistic flows, this is a particularly a problem because what happens is that you have the energy associated with the field. And so as you're accelerating this flow, a large part of the energy is in pointing flux, and you're accelerating the field, which has inertia, relativistically. Okay, so basically you're using the field to accelerate itself, and it's hard to do. There are other specifically electromagnetic effects that play a role in this. For example, the magnetic tension, or in the case of relativistic flows, the electric field, tends to acceleration. It tends to cancel out a large fraction of the magnetic forces that try to accelerate a flow. Okay, and so relativistic electromagnetically accelerated flows try to keep a large fraction of their energy in the form of pointing flux and avoid conversion into kinetic energy. So to get the flow to convert into kinetic energy, you either have to wait for it to go over a large distance and sort of expand gradually, or you have to do the acceleration using some kind of a dissipative effect, which is usually not in your MHD theory. And one piece of evidence that you need something like this is the fact that there's evidence that the Crab Nebula jet gets most of its energy dumped into kinetic energy pretty early on. There's a lot of theories about how this works, but I don't think there's complete agreement about it, or even partial agreement. And finally, the other thing I wanted to point out here is that although electromagnetic effects are believed to be responsible for many of these relativistic flows, they in fact are not necessarily responsible for all of them, and radiation pressure is probably important in accelerating some of the most powerful winds that we know of, which are from broad absorption line quasars. SS-433 is an object whose energy flux exceeds the Eddington limit, we think, and it's a good chance that that jet is accelerated largely by radiation pressure. Even gamma ray bursts, which get up to Lorentz factors of 100, are coming from such optically thick regions that it would be quite easy to accelerate these flows just by dumping a lot of radiation into the gas and letting it expand adiabatically. And so we would be dealing then with a much simpler acceleration process than these more directional and more complex coherent electromagnetic mechanisms, but we really just don't know. So the message here is don't forget radiation pressure. The approaches, the analysis that's done on this involves this very complicated equation, which is usually called the Grad-Shafranov equation, sometimes the Grad-Shafranov-Schlüter equation. People are studying instabilities that can occur in flows where you have magnetic fields that tend to kink up. There are non-ideal effects that need to be studied, dissipative effects that probably are involved in accelerating relativistic flows. And again, computation is a key part of this, an increasingly important part of this. And observation are the same sorts of things, involve the same sorts of things that I talked about in the earlier problems. And you see these are getting more and more complicated. Actually, this is because it's getting closer and closer to what I work on, but I think also these problems are complicated. So the challenges, well, there's a lot of challenges here. The basic qualitative picture of how things get propelled electromagnetically is really not understood very well. There are two competing pictures. There's one in which you actually take a stiff magnetic field and spin it around, and gas gets flung out magnetocentrifugally along the field line, like a bead on a wire. Another possibility is that you wind up the field and then just let it expand like a spring. Sorry? I know it's the same thing, but it's qualitatively has different, yeah. We also don't know how coherent these fields are, whether the fields are really single field lines that just start down here and sort of do that all the way out to 100 kiloparsecs, or whether in fact the field coming off a disk is much more chaotic. And that, I think, that has a large relationship to one of my later problems, which has to do with what's going on inside the disk. So we're starting to move towards the boundary between the jets and the disks. I've mentioned the mass loading problem before. There are some interesting questions about radial structure, which Penck will probably tell me are all just a single thing. Are jets just the fast inner parts of disk winds, or are they somehow a different structure? How do jets get confined? Okay, they have this magnetic energy. Now, probably I'm going to get in trouble here. People think that magnetic fields are nice because they not only propel jets, but they also confine jets. Okay? But on the other hand, you can't take isolated magnetic fields and put them in space, and they just don't sort of stay together. They move apart. And so there's people worry a lot, or seem to worry a lot, about what collimates jets and what confines jets. And I think many people believe that you actually need a sideways confining medium to collimate a jet, but that's not in fact true. Because magnetic fields, what magnetic fields do is they transfer stresses over large distances. They don't create their own confining stress, but they transfer stresses from one place to another, and they can do so in an extremely directional fashion. And so if you have a jet coming out of a disk, this is from an old conference proceedings about 10 years ago, coming up like this, and it's got this magnetic field. These are the poloidal field lines, very sketchy. And you want to collimate it. Well, one way to do that is to confine it by an ambient medium on both sides. But another way to do it is to transmit stresses from the disk upwards. And you can do that provided that there is a causal connection between the disk and the jet, which means that it hasn't expanded too much. This process probably at least seems to occur in simulations and leads to these very nice magnetic towers, which do seem to confine themselves. Okay? And so magnetic confinement is a very subtle thing, and it may be that disks can provide enough inertia to confine jets over very large distances, even after the jet appears to be escaped from the region near the jet. Okay, I better move on to the next topic, which will put me in even more trouble, probably. Number four, do disks really support dynamos? I can't really answer this because I don't really understand what a dynamo is. We had some discussions of it at the workshop here last week, and every time I talk to an expert in dynamos, I think I understand it less. I think what we're talking about by a dynamo is some kind of means for generating large-scale fields, presumably from some process which has a statistical component in the case of a disk, because we think disks develop a magnetohydrodynamic turbulence. If you ask most people whether disks develop dynamos, they will probably say yes. And if you ask them why, they'll say MRI, magnetorotational instability. And if you ask them to please amplify on that, they'll amplify on it. And if you ask for a little more detail, then you'll get that. And they might start to get irritated. I didn't see Steve Balbus here this morning, but it's probably true that you can develop some interesting field structures from the turbulence developed by MRI. But I think there are a very large number of unanswered questions about this, and here are some of them. Most people seem to want magnetic field structures in disks both ways. They want all of the field to be generated completely internally by MRI, which would be very nice because then you don't have to worry about the boundary conditions on the magnetic field at large distances. But if that happened, then you have to ask why you would end up with the field having a particular polarity or retaining a polarity for any particular length of time. And maybe it's just sort of a critical phenomenon where the disk flips into one-handedness and then it stays there for a while and then eventually it flips into a different direction. But, you know, that could be a long time away. On the other hand, the material that's coming in at the outer parts of the disk probably has some magnetic field, which may have its own polarity as a boundary condition. And so there's a real question as to whether the disk remembers anything about the polarity of the field at infinity, and whether the magnetic field that's prevalent in the center, even if it's just a small bias in the direction of the magnetic field, is really a relic of the boundary conditions at large distances, or whether it's a completely locally generated thing. I think this is probably a really difficult problem. Another way of posing this would be to ask whether field is ever dragged into the center of the disk by accretion. And there's a real debate, there's a real range of opinions on this field, ranging from the people who want to do everything locally I think Roger Blanford would like to say that the field is dragged in, and in fact it's so strong when it's dragged in that it probably quenches MRI to a large extent. At least that's what he's been playing with lately. I think that this problem is really open. Now, people want it both ways, because the same people who want MRI to generate all the field also want the jet to be produced by a really nicely organized single polarity field, where the field is just a big helix. I think it's really questionable whether that happens. For example, if you have MRI going on in a disk, and this is a admittedly two-dimensional example, so it's not real MHD turbulence that you would ever see, but you do get some overturns of fields here. Daniel Proga did this simulation. You do sometimes see the introduced polarity from the upper hemisphere migrating into the lower hemisphere and getting somehow entrained in the jet going off in the wrong direction. And so maybe what could happen is that you end up with the field getting scrambled and jets coming off with fluctuating fields. And if that's the way jets are produced, they probably behave a lot differently from the jets that are produced by nice field lines that are sort of a single direction helix. Okay. One needs to ask these questions not only for the disk, but for the whole system, which includes the corona and the winds, which is another way of saying what I just said. And this is one problem where my approaches slide only has computation on it, because it's one of the problems I just don't see a very good way of approaching this problem without pretty sophisticated simulations. Too difficult to do much with much more than has been done with analysis, and it's really not ready for observations yet. But one can imagine doing some things with observations related to the observation of polarity flips in jets, perhaps with diagnostics that involve polarization and radiative transfer effects in magnetized plasmas. Okay, number five. Same as, a continuation of numbers 3 and 4. So we're moving now from jets down to disks. And we might ask, how do disks lose or transport energy and angular momentum, both of which they have to do? We know that both angular momentum and energy must be transported. And the basic reason for that is that the virial theorem says that when you draw something deep into a gravitational potential well, only half of the potential energy goes into kinetic energy. The rest goes somewhere else. Angular momentum is necessary to draw rotating material deeper into the gravitational potential well. And when you transport angular momentum, you exert torques, and that automatically transports energy. Okay, so energy and angular momentum transport go together. We also know that circulation or outflows of some kind are expected in disks which do not get rid of this energy in a radiative fashion, and that's because what happens is that the angular momentum transport from the inner part of a disk to the outer part of the disk takes energy from deeper in the potential well and dumps it in the gas that's further away. The gas that's further away gets too much energy to stay bound to the central object. And so you can make this very simple argument that the torque has to balance the angular momentum transport associated with accretion. That means that there is an energy flux, which is the torque dotted into the angular velocity. That's just like the equivalent of force dotted into velocity for linear momentum. You can then show that that implies that this function, which is sometimes called the Bernoulli function, which is kinetic energy plus potential energy plus enthalpy, that's positive, and that means that little bits of the gas can do pressure PdV work against other bits of the gas and unbind itself from the system. Okay, so that the disk basically is explosive. It can go out to infinity and still have energy left over because it's receiving this conveyor belt of energy from further in. This works. You can also make an argument. That was an argument based on the idea that the angular momentum transport or energy is internal to the disk. You can also make an analogous argument saying that somehow you transport the energy off the sides of the disk and you still get energy loss. So it's still it's a generic argument and doesn't really depend on the details of the transport. Okay. Now, what this means is that unless accretion disks are very efficient at getting rid of all their energy radiatively, and that means they have to get rid of at least 2/3 of their energy when they're in the Keplerian part of the gravitational potential, they're going to become unbound. They're basically going to puff up. And so it used to be we assumed that accretion disks were radiative. They got rid of almost all their energy. You can sort of turn that problem around and say that unless they're extremely efficiently radiative, they're going to have to blow off winds. And that means, for example, that if some of the angular momentum gets dumped in a low-density region like a corona, just any part of the disk that can't radiate that receives a significant part of part of the energy that's liberated is going to get blown away. And I think people have come around to the idea that in most cases, even when disks appear to be radiating a lot, they probably produce pretty large outflows that may be competitive with the energy that's liberated in other means. And the latest example of this, I think, is the broad absorption line outflows, which have now been seen in X-ray absorption. And these are winds that come from quasars, which for the most part do not produce very powerful radio jets. Nevertheless, there is outflowing material with a very large column density, and it seems that this material could be carrying a very large fraction of the energy liberated by accretion. I say seems because the analysis does depend on knowing how far away this material is from the central object, and if somehow it's able to do this absorption while it's still very close in, you can suppress the energy flux somewhat. But people think, because these flows do not vary with time, that they're far enough away that this represents a very large amount of energy. Okay. Now, the other point that I want to make here is that conducting disks that do not have extremely strong magnetic fields are always unstable to MRI, and this has really made it a very difficult problem to figure out what happens to the energy and angular momentum in accretion disks. We actually have a pretty good idea of what goes on in accretion disks of the old 19th century variety, where we didn't know how angular momentum was transported. There, we just assumed that there was some kind of viscosity, which you can parameterize by alpha or something like that, any kind of phenomenological viscosity. And then you don't do magnetohydrodynamics, you just do gas dynamics. And it turns out that the energy dissipated by the viscosity, by the friction, tends to work in such a way that it drives these disks convectively unstable. And like convectively unstable stars, the convection is fairly efficient. And so these systems relax to a state which is very close to marginal convective stability. This is a little bit more complicated than the convection in a star, which satisfies the Schwarzschild criterion that the entropy shouldn't decrease outwards. This convection involves both the effects of rotation and the effects of convection, and it's a two-dimensional criterion. And the marginal stability criterion is that the angular momentum and the specific entropy contours are coincident, that entropy and angular momentum are the same on the same surfaces, which is sometimes called gyroentropic. And numerical simulations show that hydrodynamic viscous disks become gyroentropic. Well, you can't use this approach in a magnetically dominated disk. It's completely different. And that's because you can't turn off MRI. There's no way to satisfy the boundary conditions, it seems, and for the disk to relax to a state of marginal stability where there is no MRI anywhere. Okay? Hank, you were knitting your brows. Okay. Oh, well, okay. I think that that's what must be what it is, but anyway, boundary conditions. Anyway, so we put it off to infinity. Okay, so there's no marginal stability for MHD, but people have simulated magnetohydrodynamic disks, and they don't become gyroentropic, but they do relax to something which looks kind of organized. So even though there's no marginal stability, the disks look organized, and we just have no idea what the organizing principle is. What appears to happen is that they tend to rotate more on cylinders. And according to von Zeipel's theorem, that suggests that the pressure and density are the same on the share contours, which means it's barotropic. It's not exactly barotropic, and in fact, you can show that it probably cannot be barotropic, but it's closer to rotation on cylinders than the hydrodynamic disks. Okay, well. So MRI presumably generates some kind of turbulence, which may or may not be a dynamo, depending on what your definition of a dynamo is. And that leads to some organizational principle for disks. But we really don't know what that is. And it may even be that there is still some kind of marginal stability criterion going on, marginal stability effect going on here, because you now have a variety of processes going on. You probably shouldn't be reading this. This should have been revised. But magnetorotational instability tends to create a very large toroidal field. It twists up the field in the phi direction. And it may just be that buoyancy effects leading to convection can actually occur on a shorter time scale than the angular momentum transport effects associated with MRI. And so it may well be that what's happening in disks is that the MRI does create this toroidal field, this phi field, and the phi field floats upwards, and at the top of the disk it generates the jet. And at the same time, the clue to that happening would be some kind of a structure that's governed by the buoyancy of the magnetic field. This, as I've already spent too much time saying, this is a pretty complicated problem, and there's a variety of approaches that are being used and a variety of challenges. One of the things that's particularly important is to try to model thin disks in three dimensions. One would like to think that that when you have a thin disk which can radiate away a significant fraction of its energy, you get a decoupling between the vertical structure and the radial structure, and so things might be simpler to analyze. On the other hand, it's actually more complicated to compute, and that so far, and that has to do with the dynamic ranges that you need in different directions. So that's something that I'm pretty sure will be done soon. One wants to look at wind launching mechanisms. I think from an analysis point of view, this need to get rid of energy and the deduction that the energy probably is lost largely through outflows is a generic argument, which is very interesting because it does not relate to a specific energy transport mechanism. It has to happen no matter what the transport mechanism is. And so separating out the generic principles of how this works from specific models, I think, is a very important thing that can help to help us to understand what's going on. Okay, now I have two problems that are pretty much specializations of my last problem, which is what happens in disks in specific cases where you can't get rid of all the energy that's liberated. And there's two limiting cases where that happens. One is at low accretion rates, where the gas has too low a density to radiate, and the other one is at high accretion rates, where it radiates so much that you essentially approach the Eddington limit and the radiation gets trapped, and so the energy can't escape for different reasons. So what happens at low accretion rates? Well, what we know is that stealth accretion is common. The galactic center of the Milky Way, many galactic nuclei have black holes, which we've measured dynamically, sitting in dense environments. They should be accreting a lot of stuff, and they don't seem to be radiating. Okay, whether that means they're not accreting or just not radiating is one of the issues we need to finally resolve. Well, here's the galactic center in X-rays, and I like this picture. It shows these bipolar lobes. Sagittarius star is in the center there. There's obviously something going on there, probably outflowing. There's the galactic plane. Sagittarius star not only has these big lobes, but it also has a jet. You see it? See it? No? Everybody see the jet? Okay, how do I know that's a jet? Well, it's got a different spectrum than everything else, turns out. I hope Fred Baganoff still believes this, but he was very happy for me to show these slides. So. Is it still? Yeah, it's not out yet. Yeah, that's the spectrum of the jet. That's a harder spectrum than everything else. There are also a bunch of other linear features in here, so I'm not completely convinced. Okay, so you see these flows, which are probably accreting, trying to accrete but not radiating. The main physics that's required in this case is that you don't put all the energy into electrons, or at least you don't put more than a third or half the energy into electrons, roughly. And so there has to be weak thermal coupling between electrons and ions, because otherwise the ions dump the energy into the electrons, which are hot enough so that under almost all circumstances they just radiate away, radiate immediately. And there are a bunch of proposals for how to do this, and I don't know that people have agreed generally on which one is relevant. There's another problem here, which is whether you're actually accreting at a low accretion rate and simply not radiating away energy, or whether, in fact, the outflow is so effective that the amount you're accreting is much smaller than the amount you're supplying at large distances. And that has to do a lot with how much of the energy that's liberated goes directly into electrons versus going to protons first. And this is a problem that Gennady Biznivati-Kogan and Dick Lovelace worked on a number of years ago. And I think it's a very important point that really almost nobody has addressed since then. Okay, since I only have 5 minutes left, I can really start skipping things. Okay, problem seven is the Eddington limit a limit. This is the other end of radiatively inefficient accretion. We know that there are some very luminous objects which may exceed the Eddington limit. There are X-ray sources called ultraluminous X-ray binaries, X-ray sources, which if they do not exceed the Eddington limit, they require intermediate mass black holes rather than stellar mass black holes. But one possibility is that another possibility is that they exceed the Eddington limit. There are some other sources which people have suggested might be super Eddington, and there are some issues related to growing quasars at very high redshifts when you don't have much time. It would be a lot easier if you could do these at faster than the Eddington limit. There's another effect which people have been studying in the last few years, which may provide a mechanism for exceeding the Eddington limit, and that's so-called photon bubble instability. The way that probably works in most situations is that when you have a sufficiently strong magnetic field, there is a tendency for radiation to poke holes in an atmosphere as it tries to escape. And probably Neil Turner will say something about this. Here's one of his slides. The basic idea is that if you create an elongated hole in a radiation-dominated atmosphere, material gets pushed from one side to the other, and the hole gets accentuated. It also moves, so that it's a real instability, or it's an overstability, which eventually generates probably generates a train of shock waves, and this effect and its nonlinear development has now been seen numerically. One possibility is that you can exceed the Eddington limit in an accretion disk without blowing the disk apart, and the way you do this is the radiation avoids the denser regions and goes through the low density regions at a super Eddington rate. Because there's very little gas in the low density regions, the net force upwards on the atmosphere is actually not that great, and so the radiation can get out while exerting a relatively small force on the atmosphere. Meanwhile, in the denser regions are don't see much radiation, and they get weighed down. And so you can sort of see this in this cartoon. The dense regions get weighed down by the and bend the magnetic field this way. The low density regions bend the magnetic field this way. And there's actually a global force balance between the high density and low density regions. And so the magnetic tension actually ties the atmosphere together and prevents it from blowing apart. It's not as simple as that. And fortunately, I don't have time to talk about that, but you can, maybe Neil will talk about that. 1 minute left. Okay, three more problems. Okay, see? Anyway, there are a lot of problems related with this. We need to radiation hydrodynamic MHD has done some very impressive things recently, but it still has a long way to go. It uses what's called a flux-limited diffusion algorithm for most cases, and that has some problems when you're trying to simulate these systems with very large inhomogeneities and atmospheres. Okay, well, I was hoping to have more time for this problem because it's a very important one. I'll admit that. Problem 8, how close are we to mapping space-times using disks? If we are getting a pretty good idea of the dynamics of the interiors of disks, then particularly iron lines coming out of the central parts of accretion disks, we should be able to use the properties of these to map the accretion to map the space times around black holes, and in a sense to test general relativity, or at least get diagnostics of the properties of the black holes, including the spin. The most important diagnostics involve these very broad variable iron lines. I showed an example of that from Chris Reynolds a little while ago, and also a very rich array of quasi-periodic oscillations, some of which occur at such high frequencies that they are almost certainly associated with the inner parts of accretion disks and perhaps are telling us something about the metric around the black hole, not just the mass of the black hole, but also the mass of the spin, the spin of the black hole. Here's an example of two QPOs, but I'm sure there'll be a discussion of this later in the meeting, so I won't dwell on this. And one of the things you can do with iron lines is not just to measure their profiles and the amount of energy coming out at different frequencies, but also their response to external forcing. We think that these iron lines represent a fluorescence of the gas in the inner part of the accretion disk to an illuminating hard X-ray incident spectrum, and you can do something called reverberation mapping, in which you shine a light on a disk and measure the response. And this is a very old example of a simulation by Chris Reynolds and Andy Young. And probably Chris will show flashier ones later. There are some very fundamental problems related to all this. We do not know if this reverberation mapping problem can be done, whether the inverse problem can be done, which means by looking at the response of the line, you can figure out what the metric is. That depends a lot on how you illuminate it and what the structure of the corona is. We just do not know that at all. So there are a lot of complicated MHD problems that need to be solved first. We have no idea of why the QPOs should be there or why they're so strong. Not only do we not know what sets the frequency of these quasi-periodic oscillations, but we don't know what modulates the flux from them. Okay? Almost finished. Okay. 9 and 10, I will just mention the problems, and perhaps if anybody wants to discuss them. Let me say, first of all, are disks really flat and circular? I'm not sure anybody is giving a talk about that here, but it actually is a problem because they're not flat, at least in some cases. Here's NGC 4258, which has all these masers and clearly is warped. SS433 is not only probably not flat, but is precessing. I have to show this. This is by Blundell and Bowler. This is data. This is not a computer simulation. So that's SS433 corkscrew on the sky at 5 gigahertz. There are a variety of theories about why disks might become warped. They might become spontaneously warped due to radiation pressure effects. And then finally, the 10th problem, how do disks interact with magnetospheres? And this is a good one to end on because I know almost nothing about this problem, but I've seen that there's been some tremendous advances in this that Marina Romanova is going to talk about later. This, of course, is a very interesting problem because it has to do with very sharp transitions between high and low beta plasmas. And so it's one, it addresses some of the fundamental MHD problems we'd like to solve, as well as having important observational ramifications for things like X-ray pulsars and possibly angular momentum loss by protostellar systems, if I mention protostars again. And on that, I will put up my list of 10 problems, and thank you. Have to answer these questions, do I?
Yes, you do, I'm afraid. Now it's question time. Any questions?
That's right. That's one of the problems.
Yeah, okay. Okay.
Now, are these disks which have MRI operating throughout, or they just have to have MRI in the surface layer because they're too low ionization in the interiors? I'm sure people have done calculations, but I don't know what the answer to that is. How about John? Do you? The question was whether anomalous resistivity due to turbulence has a role in the dissipating the magnetic field, and has anybody done any simulations of that? The answer is no. Okay, no simulations, really? Yeah. Okay, Elliot says no simulations yet. Well, that depends on how the jet's created, but I mean, the sort of thing you might imagine is just, you know, for an organized field, you have the field gets twisted as the jet gets created, and so it's going this way at one point, and then there's a current sheet, and then it starts going this way. The winding direction, yeah. And so you might be able to tell that, you know, if you can get the direction of the field with circular polarization gradients or something like that. Yes, yes, something like that. One possible application of this is that, you know, if you had something like this going on in a gamma ray burst jet, that would be a very good way of dissipating the energy rather than having shocks run through this thing. So that's what we got at that. And Hank has proposed something like that.
Why do you say the winding direction must change? The field direction changed.
Well, the both directions would change. I was just assuming that B phi dominated inside the jet.
Okay, sure.
Yeah.
All right, on? All right.
On.
The other thing I was wondering was you talked about a possible sort of a pattern speed associated with a reconnection front. Are there any obvious observational diagnostics that you might be able to think of in connection with that? I mean, how could you tell if what you were actually observing was a reconnection
front?
Well,
if you can actually measure a real Doppler shift, for example, on two sides of a jet, you can get redundant measures of velocity from brightness ratios, for example. That's been done in
no, I mean that, no, that's how you might be able to find, are you actually measuring a bulk speed or a pattern speed?
Right.
But how can you actually identify if a pattern speed that you were seeing, what you thought was a pattern speed, was a reconnection front?
Oh, good question. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, that seems to be very difficult. People, and in fact, determining whether the jets are, you know, magnetically dominated versus flow dominated, things like polarization and such. But there seems to be a lot of degeneracy even between polarization measurements and that you can get from magnetically dominated and shocks. You might have to know the particle spectrum that's accelerated, which is, you know, so distinguish between shocks and reconnection sites would be one of trying to understand the particle spectrum, which isn't quite understood yet. So,
throughout this list, which you keep saying, one, electromagnetic fields are important. Two, we're doing lots of interesting things with MHD. Three, anytime we want to do something with it, we have to do something about some kind of dissipation. What do you think needs to be done?
Well, I think we need to understand how reconnection works, at one point I did say that one needs to do particle simulations of plasmas. I am not sure to what extent we're ready to do that in any of these global models, as opposed to isolating some piece of this thing and running something in a box. But I think these questions of whether you can really separate electron and ion temperatures, whether distribution functions of these particles are really isotropic or not, they all bear on these observational questions. And so we need to get a handle on these somehow. I mean, these are relatively well posed problems, but in principle we should be able to solve them, but they haven't been solved yet.
But is it really clear that you need to solve the reconnection plasma physics before you can say something about the MHD aspects that determine the overall behavior? It could well be, at least it would be very nice if it did, that it doesn't really depend exactly on how you dissipate your magnetic fields on the small scales, in the same vein as we believe that in hydrodynamics you can do this. In that case, the whole thing is not so.
Yeah. My intuition is similar, but it's not 100% clear that that's true.
Very dependent on what the microphysics is, contrary to the wish that essentially all macroscopic-minded people have, that it's like a shock wave and it depends only on the external boundary conditions. Even more, the question of, since reconnection is a popular substitute word for magnetic dissipation, I guess I'll keep using it, but it's constantly said that things like particle acceleration and spectra are something that are due to reconnection. And the evidence on that is somewhere between puzzling and contradictory.
I'm not trying to be polite. Anyway, actually, Mitch, when I speak on Thursday, it won't be about stresses at the ISCO. Instead, it will be about a first step towards what you're proposing that Neil Turner will also talk about just ahead of me, and that is that in the context of the dense regions of disks, where you expect thermalization of distribution functions to be rapid, then it makes sense to take a more thermodynamic rather than kinetic approach. And what we're now exploring in a simulational vein is the approximation that where you have gradients sharp enough that in fact the grid scale doesn't do a good job with them, and you therefore suffer numerical losses, that instead you capture that locally into heat. And This is not a complete solution to the problem. It's not a proper treatment of the microphysics and anomalous resistivity, but it's a plausible guess about where the dissipation might occur, you know, where basically curl B is large. And at least you do conserve energy, you can follow the heat, and you can follow the photons. Well, fortunately, between the two of us, Neil and I have an hour of speaking. So, maybe.
Yeah, I just have a comment. I don't know whether some of the classmates presently agree with John's characterization of the results on reconnection. Does Greg have a comment?
I'm sure he did his recent work on looking at various reconnection processes. And their conclusion was that once you included the Hall term, that the reconnection rates were pretty much independent of what actually broke the magnetic field lines. But that was one particular reconnection scenario, and forced reconnection made with different boundary conditions might go at a different rate. So I wasn't sure if that was what John was referring to.
I'm sorry, what? Right, the main, the work in this gym reconnection, they were 3D originally, but they're now doing 3D work. I haven't, I thought the results were similar, but.